This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Helen Nguyen. I am the chef and owner of Saigon Social, a Vietnamese restaurant in the Lower East Side here in New York.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world. Thank you for coming on, Helen. I know you're really busy. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
I think it's really important to that we retain and share our culture and our history. When I say that, everyone's journey is very different from one another, but, you know, just understanding where your family comes from, understanding the history, understanding, you know, just the essence and the foundation of who you are as a person, I think is very important. So for me, it's just, you know, I think it's not just, you know, a phase. It's like an ongoing journey, a lifelong journey of just really understanding, your roots.
And, you know, your Vietnamese is very impressive. And, you know, I wonder this connection to our language, you know, for me too, I just love the language so much, but, you know, perhaps somehow in the journey of learning our language and getting proficient at it, we've somehow managed to grow into these personalities that love Vietnam so much, because it's evident when we go to your restaurant, Saigon Social, that it shows up in every aspect. Obviously, the food, the music, the decor. And it's almost impossible if you kind of don't have that link to the language.
Right. I think it's a beautiful language. I mean, I think I was very enamored when I first started understanding just very basic vocabulary. And I think that when you really submerge yourself, in a song and listen to the lyrics, which is what I did, and kind of like my very first teacher in the language, it was just very beautiful, but also very intriguing, because the way that lyrics are written and the way that the language is spoken in music is very far off from, you know, just like the regular day-to-day tongue, because nobody speaks to each other that way. You know what I mean? So I thought it was very beautiful, you know, and it always, you know, I always wondered, you know, what, like, why it was that way. Because when you're younger, you don't really have that foresight or that depth of understanding as to, you know, like, okay, this is like the literature form and this is the layman's term, right? But then as my vocabulary expanded, I was like, wow, these songs are beautiful. There's just so much depth and passion and, you know, the culture kind of lies in that in itself.
Yeah. And so many of us, growing up without that sort of that link to the language, there was a time where I would listen to music, Vietnamese music, and it was just kind of repelling almost. It was kind of cringy because, you know, it was just, to me at the time growing up, not understanding fully what the words meant. And
especially when you're listening to Cai Lương.
Yeah. It's just really difficult to process, right? The sounds.
Right.
Especially Cai Lương, yeah. Mm-hmm. But as you get older, there's so much beauty in all of it.
Yeah. I mean, my mom in the 80s had a very strong accent, which was really hard to understand for others. I mean, she's my mom is from Quy Nhơn and my dad is from Nha Trang. So Nha Trang has, you know, a mild central accent, but Quy Nhơn is very close to, like, you know, Quảng Ngãi and Đà Nẵng, and they, like, the tonality is very, it almost sounds very harsh because the pitch is very high. The tones can also be very deep. And there's different usage in like certain like verbs and conjugation, if you will. It was very confusing because when you're a kid, you didn't realize that there was so many different dialects, and so many different ways to express and to just to really speak.
Yeah, Guangai is very difficult to understand if you're not familiar with the words and the way it's being spoken.
Right.
Yeah. Before we get into all of this food business, I want to ask you, what's the deal with Fernet and your love for Fernet, and why is it everywhere? It feels like it permeates in your mind space when we're there, and we're offered it, you're offering it, and it's just everywhere.
So, I want to say, was it 2007, 2008? I was, at the time I was still living in Seattle. I had a lot of stomach issues. And I always thought it was because my tolerance for very spicy and very hot foods was very high. And I thought it was just indigestion, but I was having constant stomach problems. And I remember there was a few different restaurants that my friends own that were essentially within walking distance with each other. And it's where I used to host a lot of my real estate clients. And happy hour was almost a daily thing. And I got to know the team and the staff very well and became friends with the bartender. And he was like, "You need to try this, I promise you, it's going to make your stomach feel better." And so then my very first introduction, I thought it was the most disgusting thing ever. It tasted like kvak. It's very herbally, it's very minty, it's very, very strong and pungent, and was not very enjoyable at all. But then within a couple of minutes, it started to alleviate my stomach pains. And I was like, "Wow, this actually does work. What's in it?" And so then from that moment on, whenever I felt like, I needed just like a remedy for indigestion, that was kind of like my go-to, because it's a digestive and it has a lot of herbs and spices. And to me, it was also an excuse. He was like, "Oh, well, technically I'm not really drinking. This is for, medicinal
Medicine.
value, right?" So that's kind of like, how it all started for me.
Well, what's in it that has been proven to make you feel better?
I know that there is a very high saffron content. Not that saffron has, extreme, medicinal value to it, but I just know that there's just a lot of, root spices and vegetables, not vegetables, but, spices and herbs that, that you do find in old medicine.
And is Fernet its own type of alcohol, or is it that a brand of like this licorice kind of tasting alcohol?
It's both.
Really? So.
And so to me, it's just like I also, especially now when I have a restaurant, a lot of friends are like, "Oh, my stomach hurts," or, "No, I can't because I feel like so stuffed and, full." And because it's a digestive, and people usually take it, like just a very small sip after a meal, just to kind of like, clear their cleanse their palate as well as, their stomach. It's something that's become a thing where it's like, "Oh, you have a pro you have an issue, I have a remedy." Right.
Even when we don't have issues, you have that remedy ready to go.
Right.
Was a lot. What did you do before you got into the food scene?
I was a real estate broker. So at the time, I think it was 15 years. I was a real, I mean, I'm still licensed, just not working, at the capacity I was working before I moved to New York. But I started real estate in 2007 when the market crashed.
Wow.
So there's a lot of parallels in terms of, me starting the real estate career as well as me starting my food and beverage culinary career.
for the listeners, that don't know your restaurant in New York, it is to me like a mecca, because all of my friends that I value in terms of their taste all come to see you. All the
That makes me really happy. Thank
Yeah,
you.
producer friends or chef people, they I'll say, they're going to go out to see Helen at Saigon Social. And so it's a thing where I wonder, what do you think? How do you feel? Where does that, do you think that that comes from? There's got to be something, because there's a good maybe 20, 30 Vietnamese restaurants in New York, but your name comes up continuously, consistently, that they're going to come out to see you. And it's just a thing.
When I was living in Seattle, as a real estate broker, obviously your job is to prospect. It's to network, it's to meet people. It's, one of my mentors would always tell me there's two types of people in the world. There's the people that know, and then there's the people that you don't know. Which group is going to be the larger group? Especially when you're looking at it from a business, standpoint, specifically, in sales, right? And the answer is the people that you don't know. So I, believe it or not, was very timid when I started my real estate career. It was very difficult for me to cold call, to really be out there and break out of my comfort zone, to really try to just connect with people. And through a lot of training, a lot of guidance, a lot of mentorship, and just practicing, I improved and was able to break out of that, that space of fear and discomfort to really go out there and just really meet people. And I think that when you look at it from a standpoint of, I mean, even though like the core of it's like, yeah, this is my job, I found a lot of joy in just having genuine conversations and connecting with people, because I felt that when you approach, a business deal on a very like salesy and a very aggressive and pushy like tone and approach, it doesn't always work well. And it wasn't really something that resonated with like my heart and my style of truly connecting with people. So then I think that from there, it's just, over time, you build relationships, and that business, relationships that in turn turn to friendships. And then from that, it becomes a community, not just within your industry, but also within, I mean, like, for example, with as a real estate broker, you work, closely with title officers and loan officers and escrow agents and inspectors and contractors, builders, developers, the list goes on. And it takes a community to make anything happen, regardless of what industry, what your job is, right? There's always going to be like that network of people that rely on each other to make things happen. And I always found great joy in it. When I left Seattle, it was, I had gotten to the point where I built a very, strong network of people and community through friends and family. And obviously, being raised there and living there for 25 years, it's an, it's almost one of those things where it's inevitable. You like the city is no matter where you go, it no matter how big of a metropolis it is, it's still very small when you spend a majority of your life there. So when I first moved to New York, I had one friend. It was a very rough transition for me. It was something that was supposed to be temporary. It was just, I guess a 1 year semi-sabbatical, if you will, just to go to culinary school to check it off my bucket list, and then, essentially move back home to Seattle after that was done. And because I only knew one friend, and she was her schedule was very intense in that she would go to school and then from school come home, change, and then would go straight to work, and I wouldn't see her until like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. I spent a lot of my time just volunteering at school, just because I didn't really know what else to do. And from that point, it was just okay. There's an opportunity. There's an event. Okay, I would sign up to do it. Would volunteer to do it, just because I just didn't know what else to do with my time at the moment. And I think from that, it was just very natural to meet people. Because one event would lead to another, and one opportunity would open doors to another. And I think that when you don't really think about the end goal and you just let yourself truly immerse in free fall, the rewards are incredibly, or the outcome is incredibly rewarding and very beautiful relationships are born and you know nurtured from there. And this is my I'm now in my 6th year of living in New York. So imagine just like 6 years of just continuously talking to people and making genuine connections, I think, you know, has been and I've been very, very fortunate in that, you know, the community has been very welcoming and supportive. And I really just believe that it just starts with a conversation and just pushing yourself out of your comfort zone to talk to people that you don't know. And in my case, I didn't know a lot of people here. So every day was an opportunity to make, you know, a connection and a new friend and be a part of, you know, community.
You know, at the same time that I'm mind blown, I'm also I kind of see it. You know, spending time with you and the friends that we came to New York with, I could see that there's the roots of a shy person in you. And I wondered on the whole trip where this is a person who's so shy, and you just feel like a shy person. I'm not saying that, you know, you just seem like a very shy person, and you're relatively quiet for somebody in the restaurant space, you know, in my opinion. But hearing you develop from one friend to what I know now about the sort of the network of, you know, Vietnamese people across the country, and what you've built is really phenomenal.
Thank you. Thank you. What do you call that? An extroverted introvert?
Yeah, are do you consider
I feel like we
yourself to
take so many personality tests that it's just, you know, and then depending on the time of day and the mood that, you know, that you're in, you don't really know which you fall into. I think
But
we're all a little bit of everything.
do you get tired after a long day of socializing, or do you get more energized?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I feel that, you know, when I was in real estate, I enjoyed socializing very much so, just because it wasn't because my job depended on it. It was because I had a lot more control over my hours, over my schedule. And of course, you know, that took several years and a lot of challenges and adversities just to get to that point. But the fact is that I did get to the point where I was able to have a lot more control over my schedule. And when you have control over your schedule, it becomes a lot more relaxing in the sense where it's like, okay, you know, if I wanted to work today, I would work today. If I didn't want to work to, you know, today, then I had the flexibility not to do so because essentially, you know, you're your own brand, you're independent contractor, and it wasn't a job that you had to go in and clock out. It's essentially the work that you put in, the time you put in, you know, it's going to be a function of what, you know, your productivity and your success is going to be like, whatever, you know, that means for you. And now here in the restaurant, I no longer have that flexibility, at least not in the moment, because essentially it's a startup. And I think with, you know, every given startup, you know, comes a lot of sacrifice and responsibilities. And when you have a team that's reliant on you and a business that's open, majority of the week, you can't just wake up and decide, oh, you know, today I don't want to open up the restaurant, or I don't want to show up, or don't want to do these things just because you now have a team that you have to support, you know, whose families, you know, depend on them. And every decision is no longer about what your, you know, wants and what your needs are. It's essentially going back to, well, you know, when I decided that this is what I was going to do, I understood that the foundational responsibilities was there, but I think that I completely underestimated one and was very, you know, ill prepared for the realization and just the depth of, you know, everything else that comes along with it. Because before I was like, oh, I want to learn how to cook. I want to be a professional cook. And you think that that's going to be majority of your job and your responsibilities. But now that I look at it, it's, you know, people come in, I'm like, oh, thank you so much for a good, you know, like we had a great time. The meal was amazing. And I was like, don't thank me, thank my team. They're the ones on the line doing the job. It feels like I do everything but cook these days because it's now turned into management and just making sure that, you know, every loophole, every responsibility is filled, right? But yeah, so it's like you're forced to be on, right? You're forced to be on, and I don't take that for granted. I you know, it's definitely not a complaint. It's just understanding and having like a very honest conversation with yourself, as to what needs to be done to get where you like need to be, and just reflecting on the short term, long term, personal as well as professional goals that you're setting for yourself. So with that being said, it's just like, yeah, you have to remind yourself that you may be having the same conversation every 5 minutes, every hour for like 10, 15 hours a day, but every connection is different, every person is different. So it can be taxing and exhausting, but you owe it to, each customer, each interaction, to really be present, I guess, if you will, because, just because I get tired with one conversation doesn't mean that I have to transfer that energy to the next
Yeah.
person that I interact with, right? It's just not fair.
You know, having a restaurant in New York is, it's akin to like going out into the ocean and swimming out in the middle of nowhere and not seeing land at all. Six
Oh, to
years,
say the
right?
least.
And 6 years in, and you're saying it's still a startup. And there's probably no sign of land anywhere in terms of taking sort of a breather, a break, a real break where you can hand off responsibility to another person. What keeps you going? What drives you to continue every day to grind that hard?
It's truly the community. It's also the team. I mean, the team is ever changing. Especially, just looking at our journey as, how we started, like the first 2 years was a pop-up, and then it was like, okay, let's, I think I got the hang of this and have an understanding of how people eat here on the East Coast, and specifically in New York, let's open a restaurant. And to have it, have all of these plans kind of play out and be executed in the midst of a pandemic just kind of throws a huge and never-ending curveball at
Yeah.
every corner that you turn, essentially. And I think that because of that, there hasn't ever been like stability in terms of the team. So it's been very I guess you can say like the turnover rate was very high the first year or two, just because we were on shutdown, right?
Yeah.
And it was during the peak of the pandemic. But regardless if it was, the team past, present, or future, I think that once you make that connection with people and you share that synergy and that camaraderie and that alignment, it really keeps you going, just because you are no longer just operating at, your level. You're operating at your is like, absorbing like the energy and just kind of, the zone that everyone else is in. And on the days where I feel like, okay, like I'm a little under the weather, whether it be, emotionally or physically, one of our team members would come in with a lot of energy, and then you just kind of like absorb that from them. And then, we go into the whole dance of prepping for service, and then actually going into service and then meeting the people, serving them, cooking them, and making sure that they have a good experience here, and just thriving off of their experience and watching them take that for a very first bite or very first sip of broth and having them enjoy it, I think is incredibly gratifying. And you can't really put a monetary value to that, right? It's just something where, yeah, you may be having a very long day, but it's just that one moment, even though it could be like 5 to 10 seconds, where it's just like, oh, okay, this is what it's all about. This is why we're doing what we're doing. And I think that it's what they call where when you know that you're in the right field and doing what you love, and as cliche as it sounds, when it feels like it's a part of your an extension of your being, I don't think that it feels like work.
Yeah.
And for that reason, it's just like, okay, I'm exhausted, but every morning I wake up and I'm excited, to do it all over again, regardless of what my mental or physical state is, just because I know that when I come in here, I see my prep team, or our serving team, and then just knowing that, on Thursdays, this regular comes in, and then seeing our purveyors and our delivery people and having that, continued, conversations about their families, and to be able to make that connection on a day-to-day really makes it makes it ex exciting
Yeah.
and gives you that energy and that push to kind of just keep going. I mean, I don't know how to explain it, but it's just one of those things where it's like, it just feels right, you know? It feels right. It feels like home. Until I wake up one morning and feel like, okay, I'm exhausted. I can't do this anymore. I think this is, you know, the path that I'm going to continue on.
But has it happened before? Has that feeling kind of pervaded you and you've turned it around?
Yeah, I think that it comes in waves, but I think that it's important to keep your mindset strong, to preserve your energy and be very aware and cautious with how you spend your time. Because I think, you know, as we get older and as our schedules become a lot more complex and demanding, that's the only thing of value that we can truly control, you know? I mean, your finances can come and go, and there's been a lot of factors and functions from that. But when it comes to your energy, it's the one thing that you do have control over, right? The
Yeah.
one thing where it's like, okay, yeah, you know, I'm not feeling so great, but what's causing it? Is it the people that I'm hanging out with? Is it the conversations that I'm having? Is it, you know, the environment that I'm in? And then just making sure that you position yourself and keep that peace of mind and that energy going. And I think that essentially sets the tone for, you know, everything else and the decisions that you make. Just because when you're flustered and when you're angry and you're feeling all this, you know, like negativity, it really hinders everything else that you do, right?
When you left culinary school, what was lined up for you in terms of your vision for what you wanted to accomplish?
In terms of alignment, I really didn't have anything lined up in that moment. It was just, okay, the goal I made for myself was to go home. Do I want to go home? I mean, the first month of living in New York and of, you know, of culinary, the culinary program, I flew home every week. And it was fun being bi-coastal just because it's like, oh, you know, you know, you fly back and forth, but it became very exhausting. Became very exhausting, and I did it, you know, not because I wanted to be cool and live this bi-coastal life, but it was just, you know, I still had my real estate, you know, career, and that essentially was what was, you know, making money and allowing me the freedom to pursue, you know, this passion of mine. It's something that I've always wanted to do. But you know, growing up with a single mother and a sister who is, you know, 10 years younger, she was essentially like my daughter. And I wanted to make sure that she completed her studies and had job security before I kind of went off and did what I did. And so then when I made the decision to move, you know, everything was kind of prepaid for a year just because I know that that was kind of the benchmark that I made for myself, right? But also understanding that, you know, when I started my culinary program and had an amazing opportunity to work at a restaurant, I was just, you know, looking at the finances and I was just like, how do people survive in New York? I think that I was making $11.75 an hour,
Wow.
you know, and you're on your feet all day. It's, you know, mentally taxing. Majority of the people that I went to school with and also worked with were like 10, 15 years younger. And during that time, I couldn't bring myself to telling people what my background was and how old I was because I didn't want to get judged for it. I really wanted to learn. I really wanted to earn whatever, you know, level of advancement or just knowledge that I could truly absorb and take away with me on my own terms, right? Not just because, oh, you know, she's a little bit older, maybe we should be a little bit more gentle, or because this is a career change, it's completely new and foreign. So I didn't want that to be an excuse, right? But yeah, so, you know, as I was, you know, like it was my schedule was basically I would wake up early in the morning between 5 and 6. School was between 7 and noon. And then right when school let off, I would take the, you know, the train downtown all the way uptown, start my shift at 12:30 p.m. and then end it at 1 a.m., sometimes 2 a.m., depending on the day. And I didn't know that was considered part-time. To me, part-time was like, okay, maybe 20 hours, right? But essentially, that was like, my schedule. And then on Friday nights, I would take the last flight out from New York to Seattle, land in Seattle like between, 11:30 midnight or whatever it was. And then Saturday, Sunday was my real estate days. Crank out as much as I can, meet as many people, get as much done. Sunday night, take the red eye flight out from New York, land, or from Seattle to New York, land in New York at between 5 to 6:30 on Monday mornings, and then go straight to school from the airport. And that was pretty much the very first year of me living in New York. And I think as I delve deeper into my culinary studies and my culinary journey, if you will, I was like, I really love this. I came home and I cried every single night that first week of work, just because it wasn't what I imagined it to be. I was like, cooking's supposed to be fun. I didn't realize that, it was going to be so physically taxing and, so demanding on your schedule and your body, right? But towards the end of my culinary program, there was this resurgent in, I guess, Vietnamese dining. There was new restaurants that were being opened. They were, all, became very wildly successful, and people were so receptive of it. And something just clicked inside of me. I'm like, I don't know what's going on, but I want to be a part of it. Regardless if how small my contribution is, I just really felt very excited, very inspired. And though I was tired, I felt that, okay, maybe this, I loved real estate. I still love real estate. It's, definitely like a passion of mine, and I think will forever be, a part of me. But I love cooking and hospitality more. And I just knew that, there are days where it's like, okay, well, I can get tired and wake up and still feel excited about real estate, but the excitement I felt about cooking and just, being in that whole song and dance of, the restaurant industry just ignited something much bigger inside of me than real estate did. So then I decided, I was like, well, if I was 15 years younger, I would attach myself, to a restaurant group and work my way from the bottom up and just really do a deep dive into learning. But because it was, essentially a career change so much later on in life, I didn't have that luxury of time to be like, okay, I'm going to start, from here. And when you think about finances, there's no way that I can continue supporting my family, my mom back home, and then also myself living on $11.75, right? An hour. So then it was either I go back home and continue my life, as a real estate broker, or I stay here and start a business. Because at least I know that whatever I put into that business, I can have control and visibility over. At least that's what I initially thought pre-pandemic, right? And so then I was like, I'm going to stay and open a restaurant. I mean, there were so many amazing concepts that were, that were taking off, and I thoroughly enjoyed my experiences with them and were very inspired by all the operators and all the chefs and the talent that I came across. But though their food was really good in its own way, it just still didn't feel like home, And I'm sure, you've traveled a lot, between West Coast and East Coast and everywhere else in between. But then the flavors are just not the same. West Coast Vietnamese food is very different from East Coast Vietnamese food. And though we've come leaps and bounds and continue to do so, there's just like this element that's missing. And
Wait.
I'm not saying I'm the person that's going to bring it. I'm just saying that, I grew up eating a little bit differently, and people may not agree with the things that I'm doing and I'm cooking, but at least I'm giving myself and the world an opportunity to experience, me as a cook and the flavors that I grew up eating in the 80s, the 90s, or and even, current time, right? So,
What
yeah, that's
is
how
the
it came about.
difference between East Coast and West Coast Vietnamese food?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What are some of the major differences?
I think it's a lot sweeter. Well, you know what? Actually, the very first thought that comes to mind, and it's still like an ongoing gripe, I don't understand the spring roll and the summer roll thing here on the East Coast. You know, when you think about goikuang, I'm like, okay, that's a spring roll, right? And you come here and like, no, that's a summer roll.
But
and there's some restaurants you go to and they're like, well, that's an autumn roll. Like, so do you guys just name your food based on seasons?
but that goes on out here too. That there are people out here that call it a summer roll as well. But
I'm sorry?
There's people out in the West Coast that call a goikuang a summer roll too.
Yeah, and then it's just like, okay, well then it's like, oh, this is a fried spring roll. I'm like, it's a jaya. A jaya is a jaya, not like, you know,
right.
It's the terminology gets very convoluted. You know, obviously it has nothing to do with, you know, the taste and flavor profile, but I just always thought that it was always a point of contention in conversations I would have with East Coast natives, where like, no, that's definitely a summer roll. That's not a spring roll.
I wonder where that comes from, the etymology of all this. That's an interesting point. And where the hell did summer roll come? Where did spring roll come from? You know?
Yeah.
We should start there. Like, how do you go from goikuang, which is essentially a salad roll, right? Goi is like salad, and kuang is roll. And how do you get spring roll out of that?
Right.
And then how do you go from spring to summer roll? Like who?
And then from spring, you know, you get into autumn, right?
So yeah, I've never heard of autumn roll. That's a first for me.
But I mean, yeah. So that's the first thing that always comes to mind when I think about that. And then when it comes to flavor, I feel that it's a lot sweeter here. It's a lot sweeter here. From my understanding, and I could be like, you know, terribly wrong, but here in New York, there used to be a much larger Vietnamese community than there was currently now. But I think the cost of living was just like so high. Then people would move to Virginia, to Philadelphia, to the, you know, the Carolinas, to DC. And I think that the majority of the Vietnamese community that was here, they're Thieu Chau. Right, Thieu Chau Vietnamese, and with Thieu Chau, the style and the flavor profile kind of lends on like the sweeter note. When you think about them, when they make their soups, and then when you have a Thieu Chau person making pho, I feel like there's a stronger note of cinnamon, and there's, you know, the cardamom. You know, cardamom is more prevalent, and essentially changes the I guess the flavor of the soups, right? The base is more, it's sweeter.
The sweeter, cardamom makes it a little bit,
right.
Feels sweeter.
And then, I mean, I think the foundation of Vietnamese cooking is our herbs and our vegetables.
Right.
Which there is a huge lack of here in New York.
Yeah. No.
You know, obviously due to climate, you know, you go to California, even, you know, from where I'm at in Seattle, you go to the supermarket, you get a larger variety of greens and herbs. And I think that really brings out, you know, certain flavors and really captures the essence of our cooking, especially supporting like the sauces and everything. Whereas here in New York, you do have access to all these things, but they're not as fresh,
right?
Their shelf life isn't as long, right? So then there's a huge compromise in flavor, and sometimes certain dishes go without, and that's just the way that it has to go. Like, you know, rather than having to serve herbs that aren't so great in quality.
Yeah, that's a thing that we really enjoy on the West Coast, is the quality of herbs that we have out here. It's my opinion, it's the food on the West Coast is almost better. And these are fighting words for some people, better than even in Vietnam. The quality of the produce that we have, the quality of the meats that we have, access to all of the ingredients is, to me, it's superior to anywhere else in the world.
I would have to agree. I think that when you look at it from all different points, from irrigation systems to access,
Yeah.
to all of that, it's definitely the quality control is a lot more consistent, right? And I think that I'm a West Coast girl through and through, and I think my heart will always be sided with, the West Coast Vietnamese, culinary
Traditions, yeah.
offering. Even though, now that I'm, pretty much very rooted here in New York, but they're like, I mean, for one, I barely cook the food that I eat. I mean, obviously, I'm a part of like the whole tasting, and I'll taste and I'll eat it throughout, the day, just to make sure that, these are the like, the profiles that I want to share and showcase. But when it comes to truly eating, it's there hasn't really been a place where it's like, okay, this really tastes like home, and this is where I would like, to frequent every single day, or at least, majority of the week, just because nothing truly compares to West Coast cooking.
What inspired you to name the restaurant Saigon Social?
When I was thinking of a name for my pop-up, and then, I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to do a pop-up, and obviously a restaurant, might be like, in the works. I was like, I really wanted to incorporate Saigon in it, because I think about when you're in New York, it's very similar to Saigon, where
Right.
it's a melting pot of cultures, of dining experiences, where it's essentially a city and the annex of all these derivatives, right? So then to me, it's like, okay, I want to add Saigon into it, but what, Saigon what? And I remember I was on a trip. I think I actually was in Taipei. Was it Taipei or Hong Kong with a group of friends? And I was just reading different articles on my phone in an Uber ride. From one restaurant to another, and I think I was looking at property, and just essentially talking to myself, and I don't know where the word social came up, and then I was like, social, Saigon social. I actually really like the way that it sounds, and for me, I was like, I'm a very social person, back home, and essentially that's what I've been doing here as I'm learning how people eat in New York, as I'm learning how businesses are run, and as I'm learning how to just transition into living and adapting to like the lifestyle and I guess the culture, if you will, here in New York. It's forced me to be even more social than ever. And when you think about social gatherings, it's usually around a meal. And then I just kept on repeating it over and over, and I was like, I think Saigon Social is going to be the name for my pop-up. And then after two like plus years of kind of running it, I was like, I don't want to change it. I kind of want to carry it over to the restaurant, because it just sound very fitting, and it just felt right.
Yeah, I love that word, social, in conjunction with the how you're using it with Saigon. It reminds me of the Buena Vista Social Club, which, Buena Vista Social Club is a group, a music group, and social and music are sort of like food and social, right? It's like part of what we do when we connect with other human beings is, we're in the space, whether we're listening to music live, like the Buena Vista Social Club, or we're at Saigon Social, it involves people, it involves a society, and it's such a beautiful pairing.
Yeah, and I always tell my team this. I was like, yes, we are in every sense of the word a restaurant, but to me, I don't see it as just a restaurant. It goes far beyond that. I think that going back to what your original question was of like, did I know what my vision was? I didn't know what my vision was. When I was in culinary school, I didn't know what it was even when I was, building the restaurant and, getting ready for the, the opening, and what I thought I knew, I think completely unraveled during the pandemic. And I remember just talking to people, and they're like, "Well, if you were to explain to someone that doesn't know you, that doesn't know Vietnamese food, that doesn't know anything at all, what would you say the concept of your restaurant is? What does it really mean to you, and what is it that you're trying to share, with the world?" And I think that it's something that I struggled with immensely, just because what I thought I knew, I learned that I didn't really know at all. And I think starting with food, when I hosted these weekly pop-ups, my menu was ever changing. There was nothing that was a repeat, and essentially it was just, kind of like the perfect scenario for my ADD, right? It's like, "Oh, today I'm going to make this and then that," just because I wanted, to test recipes, just to test flavors and see how people would receive it, right? So that it would enable me to make decisions for the future. And I think that I was so headstrong on just trying to capture the true essence and the traditional form of cooking and only offering traditional foods, and holding back on things that I truly love and enjoy, just because I thought that in order to be very traditional and authentic, I needed to cook things the way that they're presented and as close to flavors in Vietnam as possible, because I wanted to really appease and to make, my culture and my people proud, of the things that I'm able to showcase and accomplish and share, in the culinary world. And I think that that really hindered my ability to really create, just because I was limiting myself into this box that I thought was the right thing to do. And throughout the pandemic, we all go through these revelations, right? And I just remember that during my pop-up, whenever I would see a Vietnamese client specifically, and like an elder, auntie or grandma that would come and eat, I would feel so excited, just because, wow, it's like these are the people that I want to cook for, that I want to showcase my food for, and essentially they're family members. But I was met with a lot of criticism,
Oh, wow.
and I would lose so much sleep over it. I mean, the very first criticism would be obviously the pricing. But beyond that, it's like, okay, well, if you take price out of the factor, like, let's talk about the things that really matter in terms of flavor, right? Because pricing you can adjust. Flavors, styles, and what you're trying to share and present is something that, yes, essentially can be adjusted, but is it true to what you want it, like what you really want to do? And I, like I said, I lost sleep over it. I would think, and be so sad when people would, provide feedback and be like, "This is not how, it's supposed to be, and this is not how you're supposed to do it." And when you have, this community that you're struggling to connect with, to make proud, and you're seeing that you're met with like so much, criticism, it makes you really realize, like, or really like think, is this truly what you want? And so I would ask myself that question. I was like, what's going on here? And I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out. And then I just realized that, I've been trying so hard to extract just, this person that I'm not. Because the reality of it is, I was not born in Vietnam. My experiences were from these annual trips that I would take with family, with social gatherings and different, organizations that I've grown to be a part of here in the States, So I'm not Vietnamese, I'm Vietnamese American. And I think that realizing that, accepting that, and really understanding what that means, because it's like I'm a, I'm a product of both cultures, not just one. And that it's okay to make adaptations and changes, from what I knew growing up as a child, living in California, then Houston, and then Seattle, and carrying those experiences and those flavors from my upbringing into the way that I cook is something that I really needed to dial in and focus on, not trying to be like that stall on that street corner, you know, in Hanoi or in Gwinyang, because that's a completely different, you know, outreach, right? I mean, for one, that's not who I grew up being. You know, it's not, you know, I didn't have access to those exact ingredients, right? So of course my style of cooking and my flavors are going to be different because you know, it's just you're in completely different climates and completely different countries, right? For one. And then also for two, it's just that I didn't quite understand that value, you know, or my value as a person as to what and who I really wanted to be. And I think that that truly showed. And I realized that I think mid-pandemic, where it's just like, you know, why am I trying so hard to be someone that I'm not? I should, you know, focus my time and energy and really dial into what truly makes me happy. And, you know, if I want to throw butter in my steak, I should throw butter in my steak and cook it the way that I know how to eat, that I really enjoy to eat, that I really love to eat, that I know, you know, people would truly love and enjoy, because that's kind of like my style, and that's just, you know, the flavor profiles that I'm comfortable with. So then it came back to just looking at my menus, you know, and the things that I've created in the past, and just sitting down and re-engineering it. I'm like, okay, well, I've done this because this is what I knew and I was taught, but am I okay with that? Or is there a different element that I want to change to make it something that I would truly enjoy and be proud of, because this is now a byproduct of Helen, right? Not what the community wants and not what people think, you know, that they want. So then with that came a lot of empowerment, you know, and it's like then when it came back to just doing R&D and cooking in the kitchen, it completely changed my energy, my
Liberated
perspective.
you, right?
And then I was like, wow, I'm cooking from a very good place.
Yeah.
I'm truly cooking from the heart and not holding back, because I'm gonna make a burger, and I'm going to stay true to my Vietnamese, you
Wow.
know, roots and be able to make that connection in terms of flavor. But then I grew up eating a lot of burgers, so I'm gonna put a burger on the menu. And yes, it's not traditional, but it's, you know, and some people are like, well, it's not really authentic. But then it's like, authentic to who? Were you in the same household as me growing up in the 80s? You weren't, so you can't say that that's not authentic, because it was very authentic to who I was, right? And who I am. So then it just, you know, then it was just like, okay, well, now that I have that identity, and I have, you know, I'm moving forward with a lot more confidence and understanding what it is that I want to share, it completely changed everything for me. And then it was just like, okay, if you were to ask me what Saigon Social is, I can confidently tell you that it's, you know, a modern Vietnamese restaurant. And when I say modern, I'm not saying that, you know, we're using, you know, all these intricate, you know, cooking techniques. Some things are like, you know, yes, you know, the professional, you know, techniques that I've learned, but at its core, we're very approachable. It's very comforting. And when I say modern, it's kind of making that distinction that it's obviously not going to be your grandma's cooking. It's not your mom's cooking, because I'm neither of those people. You know, modern as in the flavors are still there at its core, but it's transformed into something different, which is an extension of who I am as a person. And when, you know, we still have a lot of conversations with clients that are just like, no, this is not it. And I find it very empowering to say, yeah, you're absolutely right with what, you know, what your thoughts and your opinions are, but I'm telling you that this is what my intention for it is, and you don't have to agree. And if it's something, you know, it's something else that you want, like, to look for, just let me know what it is, and I'll be more than happy to recommend 10 other offer, you know, like restaurants that will offer the experience and the flavor profiles, and maybe even the pricing that you want, you know, to achieve. But if you come in here and if you ask me a question, then I'll tell you what the intention and the soul and the core of every dish and every experience is supposed to be, and you have every right to agree or disagree with it. But understand that as a team, everyone here knows what we're trying to achieve, from the experience to to the flavors. And every day, it's not going to be perfect, but we come in giving it our best every day to procure that experience. And you have to be okay with people not agreeing with you, and just knowing that whatever percentage of people that do agree with you and that do enjoy, that's where you have to put your focus and your attention on, because essentially that's, what matters, right?
Listening to you speak in the last few minutes reminds me of sort of like the artist journey, where you start out and you do your paintings and you're kind of just going with things, and then you find your voice and you get empowered by the vision and the feel and the ideas that you want to express. And then at some point, the critique or anything like that just goes out the window and you just embrace your own specific way of doing things. And to get to that takes years to arrive in that journey, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's different for everybody. Sometimes, people are very lucky and they get it within seconds, within minutes, if their brain is wired that way,
Yeah.
right? If they're able to make that connection, and that's really great. But for others, it may take months, years, decades, and it doesn't really matter at what age or what stage in your life. All I think it's all that I think that truly matters is that you have that awareness and that you continue to do the things that make you feel alive. Do the things that make your heart sing. Do the things that you're passionate about. And as cliche as it sounds, it's truly in the journey, not really like the
Yeah.
destination or the outcome. Because I think within that process, you may think that this is one thing that you want, but you learn through, the ups and downs, and the adversities that sometimes you're rewarded with experiences that you didn't think you needed, right? With relationships that you didn't think that you that would come of it. So I think it truly is, it's like, so long as you're aware of it, don't worry about when it's going to happen.
Right.
Just truly be present and make sure that you're being true to what your intentions and what your goals are that you're setting for yourself. And that could be a day, it could be a year, it could be 10 years, like whatever it is. I think oftentimes we get so caught up on the end goal that we forget that it's truly the experiences and everything in between that matters a lot more, that carries so much weight and value than just getting there itself, right?
I have, this is always a dilemma for me. I have, 20, 30 questions always prepared from, your experience with, Daniel. And, we didn't even get a chance to get into that complex sort of training that you went through, this idea of, the tenacity of going through the pandemic, because I know you've told me stories about how difficult it was. There's so many, things, but today, I think the most important thing for me is getting a sense of who you are as Helen from Saigon Social, because it gives me and the audience a glimpse of the artist and the artistry behind the food that comes out of your kitchen, and sort of like the even the way you've socially constructed the way the experience is for the customers that come in to eat. And so getting a real intimate view of who you are trumps all of the other questions about training and how you got to, to your journey. Just to get to hear the artists explain who they are is so valuable to me.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate all of that. I always joke, but there's some truth to it. You have to be crazy to be in this industry.
For sure.
I think that I'm learning so much about myself. I think that yes, from the outside looking in, it's a lot of food and it's a lot of cooking and it's a lot of socializing, but it's become a lot more personal project and journey for me. And in that, it's like, yes, I love doing all these things, but the most rewarding experience for me has been truly learning and having that really intimate dialogue with myself as to who I'm being, like what my past and like how did I get here, and what do I see for myself in the future, versus just the things I guess, materialistic or that's tangible, like all those things. Yes, like sometimes, like they're very valuable, but I think that what's more important is just the internal, right? At least for me,
Yeah.
when it comes to like talking about careers and your space and your voice and food or whatever industry that you're in.
I want to end with talking about every Wednesday you have a your kitchen is doing meals for older people in your community, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that and what has really allowed you to keep going with that service?
Yeah, so I mean, as you know, we were supposed to open March 13th, 2020. That didn't happen, and the restaurant at its core became a commissary slash community kitchen. I met some amazing friends at the very beginning of the pandemic, and we were working with a few different nonprofits that were creating meals for frontline healthcare workers. Started off with like maybe 50 meals a day, 30 meals a day, onward to like 500 meals a day. And I met Moon and Yin, who are the founders of Heart of Dinner, a nonprofit that has been working tirelessly to provide meals to homebound elders. Both, singular residents as well as community, like senior communities. And I remember they had this conversation with me, like, there's a lot going on right now, and we want to be able to contribute and be a part of this, but we don't know where to start. And it seems that frontline healthcare workers are getting an abundance of support. What can we do in our background, in our community, and who really needs the help, or who could really use like that boost? And they're like, well, we really want to help. They were noticed that, like, well, even before the pandemic, there was like this rise on, like anti-Asian, like all these hate crimes. And it was really sad to walk around Chinatown and see the business just plummet. And majority of the people that do live in Chinatown are the elders. And as businesses continue to shutter, they didn't really have a place to shop, a place to eat. So then Moon and Yin asked if I would be willing to just make 50, 60 meals, and they were going to distribute it to a small community. And from that moment on, we were just like, yeah, okay, let's do this together. It became a much larger operation, involving a lot more restaurant partners. And now, fast forward, we're on year three.
Wow.
It still continues to be something that's part of our operation, even though we're, a full-blown restaurant now. But I think that, it's important to make money, but it's also important to take care of your elders, to give back, and to really stay grounded, not just for myself, because I mean, before it used to be just me making these meals every Wednesday, and just essentially sleeping here, right? But now it's become an operation where my team gets to be a part of the cooking, the prepping, the delivering of the meals. And so it's just like, yeah, okay, yes, we're a restaurant, but also understand that we're a part of a greater purpose, a part of a greater community. And regardless of like how busy or what happens, inside or outside of work, it's important to have that responsibility, not just to your community, but to your elders. And, you were able to experience and cook meals and contribute. And when you look at the videos and the photos, or, just when we listen to voice message that the elders leave, it's incredibly touching, and it really grounds you and really makes you think like what the whole purpose of it is.
Yeah.
And if you can't take care of the people that have taken care of you, then it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Right? What's the purpose of it? And yeah, it's still something that we continue to do every Wednesday, and we hope that we can continue, to do it for as long as, the organization and the needs are there. And it's just really beautiful. And I mean, once a month we host them in here, inside the restaurant, so that they can have a very fun and dignified dining experience, and be able to order from a menu. And just that interaction and seeing them being able to, like, gather in a social setting that's outside of their, senior community, you can't put a dollar sign to that at all. You cannot. And, for most of them, it's towards the end of their life, right? And I think, they're very routine in their lifestyles and the things that they do. And to be able to bridge that gap between like the younger generation, and even though we don't speak the same language, food is so universal that it truly connects everyone that's involved. And I think that it's very important to kind of to carry that on, right? In whatever that we do. And it gives, I think, a lot of insight to our team members who are like, oh, before, well, you kind of disappear and we don't really know what you're doing. But now that they're part of the operation and they get to interact and see the seniors that come in, I think that, okay, maybe your car broke down on the way to work or something happened, but you're experiencing this. And are your problems really as big as you kind of magnify them to be, or, think of them to be? Or is, when you think about people that truly are food insecure, that are going through true challenges and troubles in their life versus, the mundane things that we complain about on a day-to-day that aren't really problems at all, right? So I think that, it's a very important life lesson, and also just, a feel-good experience all around.
Yeah, and it was definitely a feel-good experience for me and Bao and Wynn. Thank you so much, Helen, for spending, I know, what is a very busy morning for you, a busy day, it seems like every day. And thank you. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Kenneth.
Of course, of course.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.